Okay, thanks.
So this should be kind of cool. And to confound things, I am really high on cough syrup, so you guys are all sort of floating. It's really cool. So the last few weeks, we've been talking about experimental design and statistics, and we're just about wrapping up the teaching part of the semester, and we're going to move into the final project part. So what I wanted to do today was to sort of just go over some of the concepts that we've talked about and focus on issues that are going to be important for actually designing your study. Probably the most important concept, and some stuff we've talked about, I just want to focus on it again, talk about it in a little more depth, are issues about validity and confounds. And as we remember, the whole point of running an experiment as compared to a non-experiment is that we can make causal inferences. We can infer that change in our independent variable results in change in the dependent variable, that our independent variable causes the change. Manipulate independent variable, you observe your dependent variable. And as we've talked about, if you don't do it right, a study that you design could lead you to make a conclusion that isn't actually valid. And we're going to just talk about some subtle, some not so subtle confounds and problems, and just to make sure you guys feel comfortable with these things, because starting next class, you're going to have to start thinking about what your project is going to be. So you should at least start thinking about ideas, topics that you're interested in. And next class, we're going to start talking about how you'd actually run a study to get at those questions. So what I wanted to start with, just an example of a pretty famous psychological task that was actually invented at Michigan. Actually, no, it wasn't invented at Michigan. It was invented by, I guess it was. It was a dissertation of a professor who's now at Michigan, who was a graduate student at Michigan, who published it when he was working at Bell Labs. But anyway, it's called the Lexical Decision Task. And you guys may have seen this in some of the studies you were run in Psych 111. Basically, the job is you get two words, and your job is to decide if they're both words or if one of them isn't a word. So you get strings of letters. They may be words. In this case, the word bread, the word butter are both words. And what they're actually interested in is only in the times where the words are actually real words. And what they do is sometimes you'll get a word like bread first, and then the next thing you'll get is the word like butter, which is semantically related. So the idea is that if the way memory is structured is such that like concepts are close together, then seeing bread will prime the term butter, and the word butter will be responded to faster than a non-related word. So if you compare response time of indicating that butter is a word to, in the same situation, indicating that the word nurse is a word, if butter is faster than nurse, then it indicates that there's semantic relations between words and that you're actually doing something called semantic priming, so that the way your memory is structured, activating the word bread activates all related concepts, including butter, whereas nurse isn't a related concept. Bottom part is boring. And the whole point of lexical decision task is to demonstrate that congruent pairs are processed faster than incongruent pairs. And this is an experimental task that's been designed, it was designed in the late 60s, and it's been run a million times since then. But just because the task is a good task doesn't mean that an experiment using that task is going to be a valid experiment. And when we're talking about the validity of an experiment, we're talking about how the extent to which one's findings can be shown to be valid in the real world or correspond to the way the real world is. And there's all different types of validity, and we talked about a few of them about a month ago. But I just want to go over them, talk about them in this context, and then talk about some other studies and some problems. And your job later is going to be to figure out what's wrong with some studies. So if the independent variable really causes a change in the dependent variable, then we say that a study is internally valid. So if my manipulation of word relatedness is actually what's causing this difference in speed between nurse and butter, then I could say that it's an internally valid study. My independent variable is causing a change in my dependent variable. However, if it's not internally valid, there could be something else that's leading to the problem. So a true internally valid study, you would control everything else. You would control the frequency of the words. So, for example, if butter turns out to be twice as frequent in the English language as the word nurse, then the reason you respond quickly to butter might be because of frequency of the word as opposed to relatedness of the concepts. If the length of the word makes a difference, if it turns out that because butter is a two-syllable word and nurse is a one-syllable word, it turns out that you respond quicker to two-syllable words, then maybe you're not actually showing this bread-butter effect, but in fact you're showing a two-syllable, one-syllable word effect. So if these things are held constant, you've got an internally valid study. If they're not, if there's something else going on, then it's not internally valid. Another example is if you have 100 people taking part in the study, and the first 50 people see pairs of related words, and then the second set of 50 subjects see sets of unrelated words, and you compare performance, and you still find a difference. You can't be sure you've got internal validity because there's other things going on. Okay, and how would we get around this problem of having the first 50 people in one condition and the first 50 in another condition? Okay, you're running a study, and you've got 100 subjects. The first 50 come in, and you just point them to the condition A room. And after they get in there, then the next 50, you point them to condition B room, and you see a difference in their performance. Is it condition A and condition B that's causing the difference? Can you be sure of that? You have to do some type of randomization. Right. So what might be making a difference is that the two conditions are different from more than just relatedness and unrelatedness. It might turn out that the first 50 people are more highly motivated, or that the first 50 people are better readers, and that, you know, there was a sign up there and they read it first, they signed up first or something. If you don't remove the systematicity between the conditions that isn't part of your independent variable, you can't be sure that it's your independent variable that's making a difference. So the goal is that you want to try to remove the possibility of confounds, of other variables affecting your independent variable in different ways. And you guys should remember stuff about confounds. Even though you've been quizzed on it, you still have to know this stuff. So that's internal validity. The next type of validity is construct validity. And basically, construct validity involves a couple of things. First of all, it involves the operationalization of your concepts. So if you're interested in intelligence, you have to operationalize what your variables are. You have to come up with something that you think reflects intelligence. If you're interested in any other independent variable, height, for example, you have to have an operational variable. So you would use inches as opposed to people's perception of somebody's height. You want something that can be measured and compared. In addition to operationalizing it, you also have to be able to come up with a way to test it so that you can be sure that you're able to differentiate your theory from other theories. And this is kind of related to falsifiability. If you run a study and your results can be interpreted as supporting your theory or supporting an alternative theory, then your study isn't very construct valid. Because you're finding a result and you're saying, look, it supports my theory. But the guy that you're trying to show whose theory is wrong, he says the same thing. Your theory didn't do anything. It just wasted money and wasted time and gave some Psych 111 students some credit. So what you want to be able to do is have operationally defined theories, and you want to be able to discriminate your theory from alternative theories. In a particularly bizarre study, McGinney's had people do something similar to a lexical decision task, where people saw either vulgar words or non-vulgar words. And this was run, I think, like in the early 70s. And basically, they would see a word on the screen, and they would have to say the word. And sometimes the word would be a vulgar word. Sometimes the word would be a non-vulgar word. And McGinney's measured how long it took before the person said the word. And his theory was that it takes longer to perceive vulgar words than non-vulgar words. That something in the perceptual apparatus of human cognition makes it more difficult to perceive vulgar words than non-vulgar words, for some reason. Well, there are some problems with this study, even though it got published and everything else. One is that the word perceive, they're saying that it has to do with perceiving vulgar words, and by measuring the time it takes you to say something, what you're actually getting at is the time it takes you to perceive the word. Well, as you guys should know from like the second week of Psych 340, the subtractive method, you can't be sure what else is going on. There's perception, there's also production. Okay, you're measuring how long it takes somebody to say the word. So it may turn out that the problem isn't necessarily perceiving the word that slows you down. It may be that you read the word just as quickly, whether it's vulgar or non-vulgar, but you pause when you're about to say a vulgar word because maybe you sort of don't feel comfortable saying vulgar words. So rather than measuring perception, what he's actually measuring is something that includes perception and production and maybe something else going on. The idea is that he thought he had a theory that he was trying to support, but in fact he was supporting a whole bunch of different theories, and he wasn't really ruling out many theories. So the goal, the whole point, is to be able to rule out other possible theories. So you can kind of think of the scientific method as sort of a competition. Like other people want their theories to be right, and you want your theories to be right, and you want to run better studies so that you could show that your theories are right and that theirs aren't. So the whole point of construct validity is to get rid of other explanations and show that you're right. There's another problem with McGinney's study, and that is that it lacks external validity, or that it might lack external validity. And external validity is the extent to which what you're finding can hold true in other situations, other times, other people, other locations. And if we were to try to make some type of public policy or something else based on a study like McGinney's, we may run into some trouble. Because that was done in the 70s, and now it's the 2000s, the zeros, the naughties, something. It might be that vulgar words in society are different. I mean, just the fact that the Fox network exists has increased the number of vulgar words that people talk about. It shows like NYPD Blue and the whole Monica Lewinsky affair. All sorts of vulgar concepts are talked about much more frequently now than they may have been in the 70s. So if you were to try to say that the results, assuming that all the other problems were fine, if you were trying to talk about the results of the McGinney study and talk about how it applies today, you might run into some trouble because the world has changed. So the goal of external validity is to rule out the possibility that your findings are only specific to a person or an environment or something very small. You want external validity means you can apply your results and your findings to a number of different areas. So you run a study and you find out that the mean score in one condition is different than the mean score in another condition. So I'll move back up to the top in just a moment. But you find out that you're doing a study of dyads in conversation. You count the number of times men touch women and the number of times women touch men. And you find out that 25 times men touch women and only 22 times women touch men. And you say, look, there's a difference. See, 25 is different than 22. So there's two different numbers, so I found a difference. But you're not actually going to say that, because why? Okay, I'll give you a hint. It says it right here.
Yeah.
The fact is that we rely on statistical tests to determine whether, just by chance, we would have found this difference. And it would be very hard to show these two being statistically significant because we're only talking about a small sample and three isn't really big enough. So this is an example of statistical validity. And this is regardless of whether you have all these other validity problems, regardless of whether you have internal validity or external validity or construct validity, the fact is you're going to get some numbers, and you have to decide if the numbers are the same or different. If the two conditions or three conditions of your independent variable are resulting in similar results or different results? Are they the same groups or different groups? So first of all, you have to choose the appropriate test. And hopefully you guys have at least a general idea that you're not supposed to look for correlations when you're looking at differences, and you're not supposed to use ANOVAs when you're looking at how similar things are. There's certain rules about using just the right test. Then there's also issues that we're not going to get into too much, but there are issues about the assumptions that you're making about your test. One example is that reaction time data is not normally distributed. Reaction time data, if you take how long it takes people to respond to some stimulus, are nearly always positively skewed. There's a bunch of examples that happen really early on, and then there's a really long tail off to one way. And if you're doing a study and you're using reaction time data, you can't run ANOVAs on pure reaction time data because they violate an assumption of the ANOVA, which is that distributions are normal. So if you guys decide to do reaction time data, we have to change them. There's a few different ways you can change them. Basically, you're normalizing them, and you end up talking about things like z-scores, which allow you to compare reaction time data to other data. So, and then finally, your results shouldn't be due to chance alone. And that was the whole point about the 22 versus 25 instances of men and women touching each other. You want to rely on something that will allow you to talk about what the likelihood that your results were discovered by chance versus whether you would find it again if you ran the study again. Okay, so there's a few more types of validity that we'll just sort of, well, there's one more that we'll buzz through really quickly, which is ecological validity, which is basically very closely related to external validity. And we probably won't ask you to compare the two of them together, but ecological validity is basically how likely are these findings to occur in the real world if you ran the laboratory study. So is this phenomenon just something that exists in the lab, or is this something that exists in the real world? So in a lab, you try to control for all sorts of things. And if you're interested in how working memory works and how many words people can recall, and you decide to give them a study where they have these nonsense words that they have to recall, so you give them a list of things like laugh, bove, all sorts of words that don't have any real meaning, and then you see after 30 seconds how many of 10 words can they recall, and you find out it's 6. Can you say that this 6 out of 10 is going to hold for sentences and real words? If you talk to people in marketing, a lot of times they'll abuse psychological results. They'll say that such and such study shows that people can recall 60% of presented information. So therefore, if you have a commercial, you should present the important information 3 times because it'll be more likely to be recalled and all sorts of things like that. When in fact, they're trying to extract a real-world use for something that might not necessarily be true. It might turn out that people are much better at recalling words if they're in a context or if they're real words, which makes sense because you already have a sort of a mental structure for real words and not for false words. And you can think of an example. If I give you a list of 9 letters and I ask you to recall them and I just chose 9 letters randomly, you would get a few right. But if those same 9 letters, if I gave you FBI, CIA, NBC, everybody would recall all 9 of them because you have meaning related to the second set, and you didn't really have any meaning related to the random letters. So if you tried to use random letters and extract meaning and how they'd be existing in the real world, you'd run into some troubles. So the goal of ecological validity is to make sure that what you're measuring is something that is related to the real world and not just a laboratory phenomenon. Now, it may turn out that all you're really interested in is something in the lab, and that's fine, but you shouldn't then think that you can talk about the real world that way. So are there questions so far about this stuff? the many flavors of validity. Okay, so let's talk about some studies and sort of tear them apart if we can. You'll remember that the enemy of validity is the confound, and we hate confounds. The confound is when a change in the dependent variable can be caused by something that isn't the independent variable, because you haven't separated the independent variable and whatever this other variable is. So, Anne Treisman, another famous psychologist, developed a task called the visual search task. And your job was to, you see a whole bunch of letters, there are T's and O's, a whole bunch of them on a screen, and your job is to find the green T. And there's a bunch of green O's and black T's, which are called distractors. But there's one target, your green T. And so she ran a study where her independent variable was the number of distractors. So she either had 4 distractors, 10 distractors, or 16 distractors, and half of the distractors were green O's and half of the distractors were black T's. And there was one green T in the middle. And her dependent variable was that she measured how long it took people to detect whether the green T was there or not. So in some cases there was no green T and they had to say no. In other cases there was a green T and they had to say yes. And you look at how long it takes them to say yes. And what she found was that as the total number of distractors increases, the reaction time increases. So when there are 10 distractors, it takes longer to find the T than if there are only 4 distractors. And if there are 16, it takes longer than 10 and 4. So you would conclude that the number of distractors affects the ability to find the target. Well, it turns out that there are some issues of internal validity. For example, and this bottom thing is kind of what the task looks like, but it's done really poorly. But the problem is there's some internal validity issues. So when there's 4 distractors, there's 2 black T's and 2 green O's, and when there's 10, there's 5 and 5, and when there's 16, there's 8 and 8. Now there could be 3 things that are causing this increase or decrease in reaction time. It could be that your independent variable is having this effect. The sheer number of distractors will affect the speed with which you can identify the target. That's example number one. Your independent variable is making a difference. But there's 2 other alternative hypotheses. One is that it's just the number of green O's that increases reaction time. So that the number of things that are the same color as the target are really what's making a difference. Or it could be the number of black T's that are making the difference. So the number of things that are the same shape makes a difference. But because the number of green O's and black T's and the number of distractors all varied in the same way, you have no way of separating them. Did you follow me on that part? Okay, this is an important concept. The idea that just because your independent variable moves from 4 to 10 to 16, if something else increases at the same rate, then you can't be sure if it's your independent variable that's making a difference or one of those other things that's increasing at the same rate. So what she should have done is run the study at 4, and she should have had 1 to 3 distractors of each type. And then she should have done at 10, and she should have had 1 to 9 distractors of each type, and she should have run it at 16 with 1 to 15 distractors of each type. And then she could have found out that it could be the number of distractors, or it could be the number of distractors of the same color, or the number of distractors of the same shape. And she would have been able to get at that problem. But because she didn't do that, she's unable to get around the confound, which is that the number of distractors total is highly related with the number of the distractors of each type. So that is sort of a summary of some of the stuff that we talked about last time, and a way to sort of bring some of the ideas we've talked about more recently together. Starting next week, you guys are going to have, basically I'm going to stop talking to you about new stuff, and you guys are going to start talking to me about ideas that you've had for your final projects. You can work in groups of up to 2, and you're going to design the study, run it on each other, write it up, and then you guys are each going to each group will make fun of the other groups to, you know, sort of do what we call peer review. And then I get to grade you. So what I'd like to do now, before we go on to talking about the lab and doing some more looking at confounds, I wanted to do a quiz review because on Wednesday, you guys have your fourth and final quiz. So, if you could take out your lists of terms to know and let me know if you have any questions about things from list number four. Measures and within subjects. They're really referring to the same thing. Repeated measures talks about the type of statistical test you do, and within subjects talks about the design you're doing. So a within subjects design means that each subject takes part in every condition in all the different cells of your design. So you compare each person with themselves. And when you're running a statistical test, you run a statistical test called a repeated measures ANOVA because each person is measured repeatedly. And so the thing you should remember is that when you've got a within subjects design, you use a repeated measures ANOVA. Because between subjects, people don't get measured repeatedly, they only get measured once.
What did you say at the end of it?
In a between subjects design, people don't get measured repeatedly. They only get measured once. So you wouldn't use a repeated measures ANOVA. You would use, it's not called a between subjects ANOVA, it's just called an ANOVA, a one-way or a two-way or a three-way ANOVA. And if you've got a mixed design, you use your repeated measures ANOVA and you also include some between subjects variables. You don't have to know too much about it because fortunately we let SPSS do all the hard work. But the key is that within subjects there's repeated measures and between subjects there's not repeated measures. Between subjects is ANOVA is just a regular ANOVA.
What's a crossover interaction?
A crossover interaction. That's right, we're doing the work. Okay, so you have a graph, and we're interested in SAT performance. And we're interested in SAT performance, let's do something fun. Of people who became psychology majors versus people who became engineering majors. Okay, so we have our psych majors and we have our engineering majors. And we look at math and verbal scores. And this is four. And say 200, 800. Now, we can assume engineering majors because they tend to be geeky. Do we have any engineering majors in here?
Good.
No? Okay. Well, then we can make fun of them. Engineering majors tend to be more math-oriented than psych majors, as a general rule. And of course, you know, there are exceptions, but we're going to pretend that they tend to be more mathematically oriented. So they'll do better than psych majors on their math part of their SAT. Well, psych majors aren't that bad. Okay. But it turns out that engineering majors, even though they're much better than psych majors in math, they're really horrible with verbal, right? And part of it could be that there's a higher percentage of non-native English speakers in engineering, so it's harder for them to do well on an English verbal test. It might just be that, you know, their mathematical abilities so far surpass their verbal abilities that, you know, they've got like these little puny parts of their right brain or something. But whatever the reason, we'll say that their verbal scores are about here. And psych people, although they're not great at verbal, they're about as good as they are, maybe a little bit better than they are in math. So our engineering students look like that, and our psych students look like that. Now, first we can look for main effects for math versus verbal. The average math score is about here, the average verbal score is about here. There's probably a significant difference between math and verbal scores, regardless of major. Then we might say, okay, what's the difference between psych and engineering? Well, the average psych score is about here, and the average engineering score is about here. Maybe the average psych person has a higher score than the average engineering person. Then we look at interactions. Now, are the lines parallel?
No.
Come on, with feeling.
No.
Good. And what's going on? What? Well, the relationship changes from math to verbal. In one case, engineering students are better, in the other case, they're worse. So the direction of the effect crosses over. When the two lines on a graph cross each other, it's called a crossover interaction. It means that the effect changes direction in one condition of one independent variable compared to another condition of that independent variable.
Wait, so all the other interactions we've been doing, if it doesn't cross, it's an interaction. But if it crosses, it's specifically a crossover.
Right. Interactions mean the same thing in the sense that they always mean that the effects of one independent variable affect another independent variable differently. What the differently means changes based on what the interaction looks like. If it's a crossover interaction, it's sort of a special kind of interaction because not only is one independent variable affecting the other independent variable, but it's affecting it to the extent that it actually changes the direction of an effect. And that's pretty impressive. I mean, most of the time, you see that, you know, if group A does well on a task, does better than group B on a task, and on the second task, they both decrease, group A will start and probably still do a little bit better than group B. In this case, we're talking about the fact that one group actually does worse in one condition, but better in the other condition. It's a much more interesting finding than if the two lines were parallel. Does that make sense? Yeah.
I don't know. What confuses me though is if you have two lines that are parallel, I totally understand that's not interaction. I don't necessarily see why, because if you like change math to verbal, then the scores change. It seems like one still affects the other.
Right. So if we have something that looks like this. This is the kind of situation you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. So there are three things that we look for in a 2x2 design. One thing you want to look for is, and we'll call this IV1, and this will be IV2. So we look for three things. First of all, we want to know, regardless of who is taking the SATs, we want to know whether people do better on math or verbal. Right? We're just running a study. We want to make sure the people who are designing the math section are designing it at a similar difficulty to the verbal section, or if we want them to be different, we can have a hypothesis that they're different. So first we say, does IV1 have a main effect, regardless of anything else going on? And in this case, it would, because you'd say that the mean of the math scores is higher than the mean of the verbal score, so the marginal means are different. Then you want to know, regardless of what part they're taking, overall on the SATs, do psych people do better than engineering people? And in this case, you'd say, there's a main effect for independent variable too, right? Because psych people do better than engineering people. But we could have run two separate studies and found those things and, you know, would have been woohoo, big deal. The big question is there something else going on? And what you're saying is, if there's two parallel lines, well, they're both being affected, so shouldn't there be some type of interaction? And what we do is we look to see, if we just ran the study only on engineering people, we'd see a study and we'd say, okay, look, see, verbal you do worse than on math. And if we ran it just on psych people, we got rid of the verbal people, the engineering people, we'd say the same thing. Right? But we'd say, oh, you know, psych people do better than verbal people, than engineering people. But if we look at whether the lines are parallel, whether the decrease as you go to verbal is the same or different for the two groups, you learn something about whether the two groups are different in more than just sort of overall way. And if they're parallel, what you're saying is that this independent variable is affecting psych people and engineering people in exactly the same way. We don't see anything that is any more interesting than the fact that psych people and engineering people are different and math and verbal are different. Okay, but if they're not parallel, then we we suddenly have something that's interesting. We say, first of all, it's probably not a good idea to talk about psych people and engineering people being affected by independent variable one in the same way, because they seem to be affected in different ways. And from this type of graph, it appears that psych people do worse on verbal, and engineering people don't do any worse on verbal. Or you could also say psych people improve on math and engineering people don't improve on math. They mean the same thing. But because they're not parallel, suddenly you're seeing that this independent variable affects this independent variable differently. And that's the key. So when they're not parallel, suddenly you see something that's more interesting than just knowing the two main effects. Does that help? Okay. Other questions? Yeah?
But that would be a crossover interaction.
Right. This would not be a crossover interaction. Because the even if this isn't significantly different, the fact is that the solid line never goes below the...
But can't you just follow that it would?
No, because this isn't a continuous variable. Right, so these are two discrete things. We could assign numbers to them, but they're not meaningful. They're ordinal. Ordinal, no. Nominal. Yeah?
What's an interpretation?
What's what?
An interpretation.
Where on the list is that?
Is it just stuff like your test results?
Yeah, interpreting is sort of the ability to interpret statistics or graphs. You should understand how to interpret things. So if I give you a graph, it looks like this. You have to be able to tell me if there's a main effect for field of study, a main effect for test type, and if there's an interaction between the two. Also, if I give you the results of an SPSS ANOVA output, you have to tell me whether there are main effects or interactions, or what the p-values are. Other questions?
This is a minor question. When you look at the ANOVA, I think when we did the lab in class, you said that the residual was another for between subjects. Mm-hmm. But in the book, it said it was for within. So this is confused.
Okay, so when you see residual, you should think of it. It's basically saying the stuff you can't explain. If you're doing between subjects ANOVA, that means it's the within subject stuff. If you're doing within subjects ANOVA, it's the between stuff.
Okay.
So we just happen to be doing a within subjects ANOVA, repeated measures. So that basically the key is that what you do is you look for the stuff that's being described as the main effect, and you compare it to the stuff being described as residual. And when you do your F test, you use the main effect thing as the first number and the degrees of freedom, and the residual as the second number of degrees of freedom. Other questions? So all the graph stuff makes sense to people? If I had three levels of an independent variable here, you'd still be able to tell if there are main effects or interactions? Yeah?
Could you do an
example of that? Sure. So instead of math and verbal, we'll now pretend instead of the SATs, it's the GREs. So we'll add analytical. So we're just talking about what this graph would look like if we had three levels of one of the independent variables, and whether you could tell if there's main effects or interactions. So math, analytic, and verbal. And you're still on the same scale from, it's 200, is that the lowest you can get on the section in the SAT? Yeah, I think it's the same on the GREs. So 200 to 800. And you'll note I also did this little thing with the two slashes because there's no zero on this scale. So we would just have three points on here, and we talked about this last time. If you have a 2x3 design where one independent variable has two levels, another one has three levels, you're better off putting the three level one on the x-axis and the two level one as lines. It just tends to be easier to compare two lines to each other than to compare three lines to each other. So what you would do is you draw, let's say that the psych person isn't great on math, does very well in analytic, and about the same on verbal. And let's say the engineering person does perfectly on math, very well on analytical, and just bombs out on verbal. So the first one we look for is there a main effect for test type? math versus analytic versus verbal. And how would you check to see if that's a significant main effect? Okay, for which groups do we check the marginal means for?
For the bottom.
Okay, so we check the marginal means of math versus analytic versus verbal. So the average of these 2 points, of these 2 points, and of these 2 points. And let's say that we find that analytic and verbal are different. So our ANOVA would say that there is a main effect for independent variable one. We'd have to run some post-hoc tests to find out where the differences are, but we would know that somewhere in here there's a pair of things that are different. Okay. What about for independent variable 2? How would we find out if there's a significant main effect? What's that? Add up which scores? Okay, so the average score for psychology people and the average score for engineering people. Right. It's just the marginal means. So the marginal means of 800, let's say 740, and 300 would be like 5-something probably. And the average of 400, 650, and 650 would be like 5-something also. And if they're significantly different, we say that there's a main effect for field. And if they're not significantly different, we say there's no main effect for field. Now, this is an easy one. Is there an interaction? Yeah, because the lines are definitely not parallel. And if it turned out that instead of this type of relationship, if instead we had something that looked like this, even though part of it is parallel, part of it's not parallel, if there's any part that's not parallel, assuming the statistics show significance, this would be an interaction, even though it's part parallel, part not parallel. Because what you have to do is look at compare the entire lines to each other. So if you've got 3 levels of an independent variable, or 4 or 5, the lines have to be entirely parallel the whole time for there to be no interaction. Okay, are there other questions about this type of stuff? Okay, well, if there aren't, why don't we take a 5-minute break? And if you guys can hand in your rough drafts of paper number 4. Mm-hmm. Can you get it to me by the end of the day today?
They did?
We won't do something like
I heard they were up like by a lot, actually.
Yeah. We'll either stay, or they'll be touching each other.
Okay. All right. That's what I was
yeah,
really
it's a bad example.
Okay. Thank you.
I don't have it with me, but if you want to come up with it in the class, you can check it.
How did I get it?
Absolute party.
I think it's just going to be a drill.
It'll give you some options on the back.
Is it okay if I'm using pencil? Doesn't matter. Change the author's
like,
the author's name.
Like what
a
else besides the name change,
think,
like besides
is,
the point
it's,
you know,
it's
name,
that whole thing
what
of,
else
like,
could have led to higher ratings?
If it was all boys,
that,
like, what, there are more females reading the male paper,
even
like that,
for
know?
Female readers.
Could something be that's confounded is the type of material that they're reading to? Identify as a material.
Yeah.
I didn't see that.
Maybe all the guys. Why they were afraid.
Yeah, maybe
the
author's name have to be.
And the guys all wrote shorter, so they're not like, you don't elaborate as much. That could be. The guys in general don't know that you can't really see it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't really, I can't think of anything right now.
You said there's at least one for
yeah.
But maybe if they didn't elaborate. Well, what else? I don't know if you want to skip it and come back to it.
Let's come back.
To get the juices.
We'll get the one that we could find a couple.
Why would they read?
Because you couldn't read it.
Oh,
thank God.
Guys are sloppy writing, so you're tight. It's easier to read.
Could it? Do you like something just... Is that what he's looking for?
Because of that, just like typed.
The first thing, I said typed and written.
Guys type their papers because they're sloppy.
It's confounded is the subject.
So it looks nicer and it looks nicer.
Yeah, the engineers versus
scientists. Yeah.
And then actually it also means different type of professors are teaching too.
That's true. Also just the material is different too. So each like different material is probably better suited to be taught different ways.
Well, that's the point. They're trying to find out if the material makes a difference. So you have to vary the material.
Oh, okay. So,
but the professors are different. The people they're teaching are different. They're like, ah, I feel
like I'm like, voice typed.
In this particular case, they're written the same way. So there's going to be something in here that might be too confounded. It's not glaring as some of the examples we used earlier this semester, but there's something in there that makes a difference.
Subjects were asked. Or do they use something like that? What kind of...
So the
car... That's interesting.
You can assume it's the same. So you could assume that the only things that's different
so there's
are
single electric shock for the rod.
They see the name of John Smith or James Smith on the top.
So the name.
Is that the
positive
experiment?
Well, the compounding variable is the dropout rate.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, dropout.
What is that called again?
They knew that they were fake.
That's a term. Yeah, term here probably.
Does that matter?
It's from like, no,
I think it's just a weakness of the study.
Attrition.
Yeah, attrition. Subject attrition. Oh, my God.
This
happens to
be one of the
hardest
ones.
Subject attrition.
If you can't do it, you might
want to
move on and go back to it.
Attrition.
Yeah.
If something affects both groups equally, like it's another variable that's out there but affects it equally, then it's not a really confounding variable.
Right, right. For it to be confounding, it has to affect
maybe just the t-shirt.
So for example, like in that thing that we turned in today, like one of the things I mentioned as a limitation to the project was that, you know, the words varied between the different groups, but you know, you couldn't do anything about that. I didn't say that was confounding because it was
right.
No, it's different for all groups.
Right, because everybody saw all the same words and some in one of the conditions. Because there were four lists of words.
Yeah.
And there were four different conditions, so somewhere along the way. So by our randomization, it got rid of that as a confounding problem.
Okay.
If it turned out that we kept the same lists for recall and different lists for recognition, then it could be a confound because the list type varied the same way that recall versus recognition varied. Does that make sense? So there was a systematic difference that wasn't recognition versus recall, but it was rather words. But in our case, we got rid of that as a confound.
These are real?
Yeah. I think that
the reason
one
might not
have
been I think that he's doing my talk. Like he's doing
this. Julie. Does that mean
we
did it wrong?
What? I just gotta tell her I can't talk to her right now.
Okay, so there's
a
Trish
one.
Okay,
I'm gonna have to
Yeah, pods of
carbon.
They wouldn't also just
have
the same, right?
Yeah.
Light.
I'm
So that's a problem.
Or with the pain, they're more likely.
Wouldn't you think that they would have scored lower in the high pressure conditions?
Yeah, well, maybe, well, the point is that men supposedly work better under pressure than women.
No, but he's not testing that. He's testing creativity.
They're more. They're going to get a higher percentage.
Right. So that could be a
compounding. So that could be a compounding variable. That men are better under high pressure than women.
I don't know. It's crazy. Hold on. Let me do this again.
So they're just always like, even if everyone's in time.
I have to tell her where the phone works because it's getting at this.
They're more likely to say, I
sex
there.
I'm in
No, I have to. I can't. I couldn't do it from that screen. There. Oh, now she logged out finally.
It's like the one side's open.
Okay. So what do you think for that? That could be compounded. But even so, Sarah, do you notice that? Look how the difference in scores.
You know what
female. Even over both.
Right. No, you know what the problem is? It's the fact that what if men are more suited to use army compasses and monkey wrenches?
You're right.
That's what it is.
That's what it is. You're right. Yeah, they could be completely different.
Exactly. Snuck out
the bed. Is that you beeping there?
No, the only Anita and you, and this computer just doesn't beep.
Zero. Okay. November.
This is actually true.
That is really funny.
You know what? In the blizzard of 78, they had a blizzard in 1978 in Massachusetts or in New England, and it was in May or something like that. Yeah, it was in May, so it's really unusual. And I guess the snow just—it was like 5 feet. You couldn't walk out your front door and stuff. The snow was so high, so people were like bound in their house for a couple of days. Apparently, 9 months later, a lot of kids were born. Yeah, like the power was out for a few days.
Yes, you know what they're talking about.
All those babies born 9 months later.
It's like what Dan said. Remember Dan said that thing on the overhead? He's like those Michigan winters.
Yeah.
All right. Following.
You just more knowledgeable.
No, you did. When I told you to.
Yeah,
you
know what that means. More familiar with the tools. You just unsubscribed. Sex free. That's kind of weird, though, because
there's no reason why it should look like that.
It shouldn't. I mean, some people are weeks late. You know?
Yeah, weeks early. Yeah, no one's on time. Not enough people are on time.
So, what's the deal here? It's that I don't think it's just a legitimate conclusion.
There has to be something going on in here that we haven't figured out.
Yeah.
It has something to do with the days of the week.
What if they just like the words more?
Well, they didn't say what day of the week the blackout was.
Right.
Damn it. Thank you.
Then people like to have their kids coming out of life. God, I'm gonna be able to go out this
Get it out of the way. Damn, I want to enjoy my weekend.
Maybe the words
are
more
positive. My mom was in labor with me on Friday the 13th for 17 hours, and I was born on Saturday.
That's what I'm saying.
38
hours.
Come on. I have never heard anything that long. Did she have a C-section?
No.
After 38 hours?
It was, well, you know, like when the first contraction started. All 38 hours.
Time. Yeah. Yeah. We don't have a C-section.
Oh, really? That's why I'm always worried, because that stuff's genetic. Like, you inherit that stuff.
They're not on the same sheet.
Like, if your mother's in, like, some cancer, you would be talking like crazy. He's like in labor forever. Oh, God, that's
like... So, for the Goldberg study, the name game, this is one of the hardest ones. So, can somebody tell me what possible compounds there could be in the study? Yeah.
People like the letters O and H better than A.
O and H might be, like, better than A. Okay, and it might come up in women's names. There's more A's and E's than men's names.
What? Well, in this example, you have John and Jane.
Okay, those are just two examples. They use a whole bunch of names and the masculine and feminine forms of each. Hmm. Yeah.
We talked about the essay material. The material was something that was more straight to the female, like sports. It might be more apt to agree with the male, which is the female.
Okay, so. If the material was such that people thought male as opposed to female, that would be a weakness of the study, but it wouldn't necessarily be a confound, because it wouldn't be affecting one group and not the other group. All conditions would see the same thing, all conditions would presumably think male or equal things, even though they were different names. So that could be a weakness of the study, and if you were running that study, you have to make sure that you chose something that wasn't thought to be male or female. So the fact that both males and females scored males higher than females, you're saying it's by a difference between males and females, we're talking about the difference between the essay writers or the judges?
The judges.
Okay, so if we found the difference between male and female scores, like the male judge scores and female judge scores, we would say that could be a problem, or that could be an effect that we're interested in finding. In this particular case, we're going to assume that the scores are both the same. Males scored males higher, and females scored males higher. Other possible ideas for what the compound is?
It could also be, it depends on what the students that are evaluating it, like what their background is. Like, if you have males and females that are all the same discipline, all like from the same area, that's one thing, but they're both different. You take male engineers and female scientists.
Right. Okay.
So, depends on.
So one thing you want to make sure of is that you have a random assignment to the conditions. You want to randomly select males and females from the same population.
Right.
And if you didn't do that, that would be unfound. Good. Other compounds with active materials? Well, it turns out that a guy named Kassoff looked at the study and he thought that maybe there's a problem with it. And what he did was he went through and looked at the fact that, like, how people rate different names. He said, forget about gender. I'm interested, are some names more positively connotated than others? And he found that, in fact, there is a difference. So, for example, the name Waldo is rated less favorably than William. Even though they're both male names, some names have more positive connotations than others. And it turns out this happens for all different names for various reasons. For example, names that were very popular in the 20s and 30s might be associated with certain concepts, and names that were really popular in the 80s and 90s are associated with different concepts. So what he found was that he looked back at the names that were used in this actual study, and he found that the names that Goldberg had chosen unwittingly were less attractive female names and more attractive male names. So if you take a male name and you feminize it, just sort of the way he did it, it turns out that you have to make sure that you're keeping the name at the same attractiveness level, and he didn't do that. So what he did was he actually then took a whole huge corpus of names and he compared male to female, rings to males to female names, and it turns out that the average is the same. So it was just a problem with the selection of names. So that if somebody were to try to rerun this study, one thing they would want to do is have the names pre-tested first to make sure that they're equivalent as far as positive and negative connotations before you start making assumptions about gender. Okay? This is the most, this is probably the most difficult one on the list. So, does that make sense? That would be a problem if the names were different positively and negatively regardless of gender. Okay, so the teaching one, statistics class.
Kids who take an engineering class are just better at statistics or have some more previous knowledge, so they scored higher.
Okay, so the engineering students are just different than psych students and they're better at statistics.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. If you don't randomly assign people to conditions, then any differences that are existing may be what results in you changing your dependent variable. So if you wanted to really be sure that this would be a fact, you would randomly, you'd have two versions of the engineering class, and one would get one type, and one would get another type, and two versions of the psych class, and one would get one type of teaching, and one would get the other type of teaching. And then you can get rid of the engineering versus psychology effect. Good. Okay, the punishment one. So what's wrong with that?
It's like a list of words and
Speak up.
First of all, the first list of words could have had like more positive connotations or better related to, and then like the second list of words could be words that they didn't even know and stuff. It didn't say what kind of what, like, did they match the words to see if they were like same like difficulty level and length and all that stuff.
Okay, now since the task was to judge the words from the first list that everybody saw, how do you think that the differences in the second list would make a difference? So if the words in the second list, let's say they have negative connotations, and the words in the first list have positive connotations. The task is to recall or to judge the words in the first list. How do you think the fact that the words in the second list are negative would make a difference?
Make the first list look better. Yeah, make the first list look better. Or you could reverse it and, like, the other list
looks
better. So.
Okay, but I'm not sure what's causing the effect. So, right before you make the judgment of the first list of words, of whether they're positive or negative, you see either a new list of words that are different, or you see that same first list. And you do bet, and you rate the first list better.
There's nothing to compare to.
What's that?
There's nothing to compare to if you see the first list again.
Okay, so maybe you have to think to compare to, so you sort of just judge them all positive.
Well, but didn't it say, like, you see a list and then you might see the same list again and you decide whether you like those words?
So what he's trying to show is he did a bunch of studies in addition to this one, some of them were better than others. In one case, he used subliminal presentation. And what he would do is people would look at the screen and he would subliminally present shapes, unusual shapes, not necessarily squares and circles, but unusual shapes. And then they didn't know that they saw these things, and they were presented for like a millisecond. So it's way too fast to even recognize that you saw something. And then later on, you would give them a big list of shapes and ask them to rate how positively or negatively they felt. And what he found was that the old shapes were rated more positively than the new shapes. So what he's saying is that his idea is that mere exposure, just seeing something once, will make you feel more positive about it than seeing it for the first time. So in this particular study, what he's doing is, instead of giving them shapes that they don't see, or things that they get subliminally, he's presenting it so that it's conscious. So they see a word, and they see another word, and then a week later they come back and they either see the same list or a different list. So that particular method introduces a new confound. And I think what you're getting at the point, it has to do with the types of words that you're presented with. Part of it. If you think of some things that could lead you to rate the old list better after having seen that a second time than having seen a new list of words. Who's confused?
It also seems like, but even outside of that, like, a week has passed in the tournament, and so there's all kind of things that can affect how you feel about a certain group of work, or even just what your mood is, what your mood was last week, and what your mood is this week, will affect, like, how you rate a list of work.
Right. Do you think that the mood would differ between people who saw the same list twice and the people who saw two different lists? Because remember, that's the point of the confound.
Yeah. The second list might put people in the back.
Right. Right. Maybe reading the second list does something to people that reading the first list doesn't do to them. So it might be, for example, that if the second list includes some negative words, people might be in a bad mood. And in a bad mood, they might rate everything lower. So that might be what's causing the problem. So it's kind of what you're saying is the idea that they might be in a different mood, but what you need to be able to say is that something in one condition caused their moods to change differently than in the other condition. Okay. So let's talk about blackout babies. Have any of you guys ever heard that about after a blackout, there's rise and births? So what's wrong with that? So looking at Monday, Tuesday, you're saying to say take the week before, the week after the date, 9 months later than the date, compare that to other times that you read the Google phone. Right. Now part of that is good. In fact, it turns out that there's about a week. The standard deviation of birth is about a week in either direction. So there's 9 months, then plus or minus a week. That's your rookie bar. So getting a bigger picture would be better. But you can imagine if that standard deviation occurred all the time. The year before, the same type of standard deviation occurred, and it wasn't. Weren't as many on Monday and Tuesday as compared to Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. It ends up turning out that a lot of births aren't natural, sort of, you know, the baby's coming and switching to the hospital ones. A lot of them are induced, and then there are cesareans. And doctors tend to induce pregnancy and to do cesareans early in the week as opposed to before the weekend. Because they're going to be at work the rest of the week so they can check up on the mother, whereas if you're on a Friday and they go away for the weekend, the mother's in more trouble. So, in fact, somebody did a follow-up on this because it seemed a little odd, and what they found was that if you look at it by day,
that Monday of that particular week, they were like so much higher than all the Mondays on the rest of the year, they didn't find that.
It could have been if that were the case, right? You would expect that there were a main effect of that year versus other years, assuming that week was of interest. If there were a main effect, you might expect this. Right, with this being this year, the year of the blackout, this being the year before or after the blackout, then you'd still see this pattern. Right, Mondays would still be more than Thursdays, but what you would say is that there's a main effect because 2 years differ, and there's no interaction because they're parallel. Okay? So, but that doesn't negate the fact that there's still a main effect for day of the week. So, what you should be able to get out of this is the fact that even studies that get published and that look good can have confounds, and your job when you come up with your final project is to try to get rid of as many confounds as you can. And ideally, you should think of a problem in the world and try to operationalize that problem and try to run a study on that. And I think what you do is to get you thinking about this. I'll hand out a description of the final project.
It's due April 17th, right?
Yeah, it's due at the end of the semester. But there are different things going on between now and then. The key that you should keep in mind is that you can work with a partner, up to two, no more than two. And if you work with a partner, you guys can both run the same study and everything, and you do it all together, but you have to write up separate papers. And your grade isn't based on whether you find significance. It's based on how you can present the data and how you run your analysis and how you basically show that you understand all the stuff we talked about this semester. Now, fortunately, during the whole semester, you guys have gone through all the different parts of writing a paper, so this shouldn't be too difficult. You've written an intro, methods, results, and a discussion section. So you can look back at those and directions that we've given you throughout the semester. So start thinking about ideas, start thinking about partnering up if you want, and start the next class, we'll get into more depth as far as what you're talking about. So, for those of you who haven't handed in your assignment for and you need help doing the analysis,
you so.
Stay here for a little bit, otherwise, I'll get to
that's it.
So you were saying you're studying a lot for the Joy's exam?
Like you wouldn't believe.
I've read over my notes 3 times.
I've read them over twice, two full times. But I feel like I don't even know exactly what he wants us to memorize. Like, we need to know every single, you know, effect and, you know, that each drug has on, you know, psychomotor stimulant.
I just kind of, like, made a little chart and kind of wrote down the basic things. Like, the fact that, like, all of them have rewarding effects except for hallucinogens and stuff like that.
They do?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I do this little thing.
Well, they're all self-administered, except for how LSD isn't self-administered. Yeah, that's kind of essentially what I did, too.
But I'm...
You're going to go to the review today, right?
For sure.
You know what? I actually, when I was talking to her last week, I asked her about that whole thing about... Because remember the part where you it says, write 2 important factors about each thing? And no one knows what the 2 facts they want you to write are?
What are you talking about? She said that.
Remember the part? No, remember the part of the exam that says write 2.
Oh, yeah.
And remember how we were both like, yeah.
And how we were
remember
like, you know, how do you know what they think is important?
You can argue. Well, see, that's the thing. Oh, you should go back again.
You can go back. I checked it.
Yeah, I saw mine. But anyway, so I asked.
Oh, we just got an email from Oz.
I asked.
She sent me one to
know. Oh, sorry.
Oh, it's about pure evals.
I'm just tired.
Not important.
Oh, whatever, that's not about us.
I'm gonna write it back.
Why are you writing for that? We don't have pure evals.
It doesn't have the results.
Are you dead?